Hello, I'm Chris Gore. This is number 0269, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0269. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, Mark Abrams from the Annals of Improbable Research with this year's Ig Nobel Prizes. He talks about various prize winners, including this year's recipient for the Arctic Science Prize.
What they did that won them an Ig Nobel Prize was they were working in the far north in Norway. Very far north. Let me read you the citation so I can do them proper justice. They tested how reindeer react to seeing humans who are disguised as polar bears.
Underwater archaeologist Marc-André Bernier from Parks Canada on the search and discovery of the sunken ships of the Franklin Expedition from 1845.
When the ship appeared on the screen, the sonar image scrolls down like a waterfall. Even before it completely appeared, because it's fairly intact, the excitement was just there. Everybody knew and started celebrating. So it was a very intense moment because we've been looking for this for 6 years, and it was finally there. I was on another ship with one of our partners, and when they showed me the images, I mean, tears on my face, because it was just an intense moment, and the significance of the discovery was huge.
Former police officer Vincent Hill, who is still trying to find answers into the murder of former NFL quarterback Steve McNair. He doesn't believe it was just simply a murder-suicide.
The case was closed in a matter of 3 days by my former department, Nashville Police Department. But when you look at the facts of the case and how Steve was murdered, or should I say executed, you know, it just never added up to a murder-suicide. Steve McNair was shot once in each temple and twice in the chest at center mass. You know, something not typical of a 20-year-old female who supposedly never picked up a gun before July 4th of 2009.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0269 was Chris Gore. He's an old friend of mine from high school, and he now runs a mobile dog grooming business in Palm Springs, California. It's called The Dog Man Cometh, and you can check out his website at thedogmancometh.com. Thank you very much, Chris, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Crystal McCullough was breastfeeding her baby in Big Woody's Bar in Chesapeake, Virginia, when the manager asked her to leave. "I said, there is no law that says I can't breastfeed and drink," McCullough said. "I'm not doing anything wrong." And he then proceeded to say, "You know what? I also have my right to refuse service. I'm going to be cashing you out, and you can leave." Now, McCullough took to social media to expose the business as unfriendly to breastfeeding moms and indicated that she was planning a nurse-in in protest. But the tactic backfired. Other patrons commented about the complaints they'd given to the manager. Not that McCullough was breastfeeding, but that she was drinking while doing it. McCullough says that while she had drinks there, she didn't drink much, and that the amount wasn't enough to affect her baby. Medical experts don't agree on how much is too much, and several advise not drinking any alcohol while breastfeeding. You know, somewhere in all of this, there's a baby wanting to eat. But I go back to the beginning of the story, which starts off like one of those bad jokes. You know, a breastfeeding mother walks into a bar. Well, we'll stop right there. Never mind the alleged exposed mammary. She could have her breasts encased in armor and under a burqa for all I care. The problem is, she has a baby in a bar. That's the problem, folks. A baby in a bar. That's it. It could be a bottle baby. It's still a baby in a bar. Anyway, moving right along, firefighters in Austria said they freed a 3-year-old boy who became locked in a large postal box during a game of hide-and-seek. The Modeling Fire Department said the boy was visiting a residential complex with his parents on Monday, and he chose the mailbox as a hiding spot for a game of hide-and-seek. Emergency responders needed to be summoned at around 7 p.m., however, when the box's door locked behind the boy, trapping him inside. Firefighters, who used a hydraulic spreader and a crowbar to get into the box, said the boy was amazingly brave and greeted them with a smile once they got the box open. Well, of course he smiled. I mean, even at three, I'm sure he understood the concept of a win. And we have a couple of items that deal with the entrepreneurial spirit and those who really love their pets, apparently at any cost. Story number one, Doris Carvello of Tampa, Florida, is raising venture capital to expand her hobby of crafting high-end handbags from groomed, recycled dog hair. About 2 pounds worth in each bag, by the way. With investors, she could lower the cost of the $1,000 price tag, since it now takes her 50 hours in labor to make the yarn for her haute couture accessory. Don't you just wonder how someone even comes up with an idea like that? And story number two, among the suggestions of the Brisbane, Australia company Pets Eternal for honoring a deceased pet, made to a reporter in September, keeping a whisker or a tooth or a lock of hair or having the remains made into jewelry or mixed with ink to make a tattoo. Overlooked was a new project by the Houston space flight company Celestis, known for blasting human ashes into orbit, most famously those of Star Trek creator Gene Roddenberry. Celestis is working with a California company that will soon offer to shoot pets' remains into orbits. That's $995 if you want to send your pet into orbit, or perhaps even to the moon. That'll cost you a cool $12,000. Yeah, again, fascinating ideas for people with more dollars than cents. On to Venezuela for our next story. Venezuela, already in a recession, suffered a particularly cruel blow, according to a September Associated Press dispatch from Caracas. With the recent shortage in availability of breast implants for its beauty-obsessed señoritas. Now, restrictive currency controls are limiting enhancement surgeries from the 85,000 performed last year. And according to a local joke, this will force Venezuelan women to start developing their personalities. However, according to a leading surgeon by the name of Dr. Daniel Slobodianic, when potential patients are told their preferred size implant is backordered, many merely choose the next largest available size. Yes, a story about boobs in every sense of the word. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, and while we're still on the topic, by the way, of breasts, an August West Virginia Board of Medicine report accused Martinsburg doctor Tressie Montaigne Duffy, age 44, and owner of a weight and wellness clinic, of overprescribing drugs and repeatedly exposing herself to coworkers, including forcing one employee to motorboat Duffy's surgically enhanced breasts. I think she's taking the old adage of if you got 'em, flaunt 'em a little too seriously. Don't you think? Anyway, on to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Another year has gone by, and it's time once again to talk about the annual Ig Nobel Awards. Each year, we chat with Mark Abrams from the Annals of Improbable Research, who put on the event. So, who are the big winners this year? Time to find out. Mark is on the line with us via Skype to Skype communications. Hi, Mark.
Hello, Peter. Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure to have a chance to talk to you, sir. And this year, like every year, you guys have outdone yourselves. I guess it was only a matter of time before the physics of stepping on a banana skin would show up.
That could well be. And time arrived at its big moment this year. The physics prize went to a Japanese team. They very carefully measured the amount of friction between a shoe and a banana skin, and between the banana skin and the floor when a person steps on a banana skin that's on the floor.
Now, we have fun with these. You guys certainly have fun with these. But behind almost every one of these, there's some real science. So what's the real science behind this one?
They wanted to find out just how slippery that stuff is inside a banana peel. And they wanted to know, partly because they wanted to know whether that substance that's inside, that mixture of substances inside a banana skin, might be useful for other things. They've even been talking about maybe when they reconstruct somebody's knee, when your cartilage stops being so so much of a lubricant, maybe some of the stuff that's inside a banana might be helpful. Believe it or not.
Interesting indeed. Now, I've always mentioned on this program, people who listen to the show on a regular basis know I'm not necessarily the biggest fan of cats. I've even written blogs about it. So when I saw the mental hazard of cat ownership, it really perked my ears up.
Yeah, that prize was shared by two different groups. One of them is in Europe, based mostly in the Czech Republic. The other group is in the U.S. and India. The first group has been looking for decades now at a particular kind of parasite, little tiny microscopic creature that lives inside the brains of many cats and that can fairly easily be transferred from the cat to the brain of the owner. And it's a parasite that sometimes sort of hijacks the brain. It causes whatever it's living in to start behaving in a very different way. Kind of nasty, huh? And the other group looked at some medical records, a lot of medical records, to see whether people who've been bitten by cats badly enough that they go and get medical treatment have other things on their medical records, and discovered that an awful lot of people who have been treated for cat bite also have been treated at some point in their lives for depression.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, that second one, it's not at all clear, even to the people who did it, whether there's any kind of cause and effect between the cat bites and depression. And if there is cause and effect, who knows which direction it goes in, which leads to the other. But boy, it's interesting that in so many cases the two things go together.
I wonder if one of the symptoms would be you can't stop playing with the cord for the drapes.
I guess so, or you know, can't stop interviewing people on the radio.
No, I stay away from cats. I know whatever they have, I don't. I stay away from them completely.
I believe you.
While we're dealing with animals, what's the deal with the north-facing defecating dog?
Wasn't just one dog. This is a group in, again, the Czech Republic and also Germany. It's a large team of scientists. They have been measuring the direction that dogs are facing in while dogs are sort of on their own urinating and defecating. They say that their evidence shows that fairly often dogs will align the long part of their body, the long direction, with the magnetic lines around the Earth, from the Earth's magnetic field. And they're trying to figure out what that means.
Oh, so they've quantified that it's happening, but they don't know why.
They have. Other scientists are asking questions about whether the work was done carefully and about whether there might be other things going on. The scientists themselves have an app that you can download to your computer where you can put in data about your own dog if you have a dog. They're trying to get a lot more data from around the world about what dogs do.
That actually sounds fascinating, as they all do, by the way, as they all do. Now, I understand this is the, 24th year now?
Right. We just had the 24th first annual Ig Nobel Prize ceremony.
And it's getting bigger and better each year. Did you also have, a mini opera that was performed? Or at least a...
Yeah, this is the, I think, the 19th time we... The big thing in the ceremony is that we're introducing the 10 new Ig Nobel Prize winners. They're a secret until they step out onto the stage. But between those announcements, we do lots of other things. And one of the things we do every year is write a little opera about something in science, something funny, and we perform it with real opera singers. And then we have the Nobel Prize winners and other famous scientists on stage also have bit roles in that opera.
Fascinating. And speaking of Nobel laureates, there were several of them. How many did you have this year? Four Nobel laureates, I believe, were this year's ceremony?
Four Nobel laureates were part of the Ig Nobel ceremony this year, handing out the prizes. We had six that morning. Two of them had family illnesses that came up, so it prevented them from coming. But everybody seemed to be having a pretty good time.
Canada was involved, if I'm not mistaken, in one of the situations, and it involved seeing, well, Jesus and toast, among other things.
Yeah, boy, that sounds especially strange, the way you phrased it. Canada had a part in two prizes. That was one of them. It was a team that's partly in Toronto and partly in China. They're trying to get some understanding of what happens inside people's brains while people are doing things like seeing the face of Jesus on a piece of toast. They're interested in what happens when people are looking at something and seeing patterns that not everybody else sees.
Okay. It's like seeing faces in houses too, right?
Or if you look up, seeing faces in clouds or other things in clouds or anywhere. Yeah.
And what was the other Canadian?
The other group is a base is in Norway. One of them earlier in his career worked in Canada for a year. What they did that won them an Ig Nobel Prize was they were working in the far north in Norway, very far north, and they let me read you the citation so I can do them proper justice. Okay. They tested how reindeer react to seeing humans who are disguised as polar bears.
Okay.
Like, know why they?
that was my next natural question. Yes.
Okay. They study animals that live in the far north. As the climate is changing up there, the polar bears are gradually moving a little more south than they used to be because the ice is melting where they have been. So they're moving southward. Well, it's a little more complicated. But anyway, the two animals are moving closer to coming in contact with each other more often, the reindeer and the polar bears. And these scientists are wondering what's going to happen to these reindeer when they start running into polar bears often, because the polar bears can pretty easily wipe out and eat a reindeer. So they wanted to do a test. What does a reindeer do if it sees something in the far distance that's white and that's moving? So one of them disguised himself as a polar bear. Wasn't a very good costume, but it didn't have to be because they were doing this at a distance. And now they have some idea of what happens.
And so what happens?
Oh, I was wondering if you'd ask. Reindeer usually, when they see something white in the far off, will start running away from it. So that says that there's reason to hope that the reindeer will protect themselves.
You'd think, though, that the first test would be how good is the vision of a reindeer? Because something white in the distance, I mean, if a reindeer doesn't have 20/20 vision, how do we know that he or she sees this?
They already, from many years of experience with reindeer, have a fairly good idea of how reindeer's eyesight works. And they thought of doing this test really on the spur of the moment. They were already up there, and they've been talking about the general question of what's going to happen to the reindeer. They realized, hey, we can do a sort of quick and dirty, or I guess since it's white, the opposite of dirty. So they had some bandages and things like that, and they improvised on very short notice. And if you look at the photographs of them up close, it looks ridiculous. The guy who's imitating a polar bear really looks like a very cheap, quicko version of the old 1930s horror movies about the mummy. But from a great distance, it just looks like something white and tall that's moving.
And they haven't thought of doing the opposite, right? That's dressing as a reindeer and seeing how it affects polar bears?
Oh, I don't know what their plan is, but if I were them, I don't think I would really want to be doing that, because what they're pretty sure about is if a polar bear sees something edible, it's going to try to move closer and eat it.
Fair enough. Again, this is always fascinating, and we've run out of time, basically, but people can actually, I understand, see the entire ceremony on YouTube, correct?
Yeah, go to our website, improbable.com, and you can see video of the whole ceremony, including all of the researchers we've just talked about, and that opera, and lots more.
When you guys started this some 24 years ago, did you ever think it would be as big and as broad as it is today?
Oh, yeah. And we're still in the early days.
Well, how much bigger can this get?
Gee, I don't know. Well, every year, though, it gets a lot more attention around the world. And every year, more and more people send in nominations for Ig Nobel Prizes. In most ways, it really does feel like it's growing and growing. I'm not sure whether that's a wonderful or a terrible thing for the world, but I'm happy about it.
Well, Mark, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. I thank you once again for being on the program with us.
Thank you, Peter.
Mark Abrams from the Annals of Improbable Research. They are the folks who put out the annual Ig Nobel Awards, and you can find out more information by going to their website at www.improbable.com. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0269, and you'll find the links.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Batteries not included, some assembly required.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk about the search for the Franklin Expedition up in Canada's Arctic, and we'll look into the murder of NFL star Steve McNair. One man doesn't think it was a simple murder-suicide. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day and lots more stuff on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, police in Japan's Kyoto Prefecture raided a shoe manufacturer in July and commandeered a list of about 1,500 purchasers of the company's signature Tosatsu shoes, shoes with built-in cameras. Investigators have begun visiting the purchasers at home to ask that they hand in the shoes, but out of fairness, they say they would not cause trouble for customers who could produce a legitimate reason for needing to take pictures and video by pointing their shoe at something. The seller was charged with aiding voyeurism and fined the equivalent of about $4,500 under a nuisance prevention law. Oh, I think I'm more interested in those legitimate reasons folks are going to come up with for having shoe cameras. I wonder what they could be. I wonder. Meanwhile, Ontario's top court rejected Brian Teske's complaint in August over how Roman Catholics continue to be discriminated against by the laws of British royal succession. Even though Ontario, along with many other Commonwealth locations and countries, recently removed some aspects of bias, ending the ban, for instance, on the royal families marrying Catholics. Now, Teske pointed out that Canadian Catholics still do not have a fair shot at becoming king or queen, although Teske did not claim that he personally had to be a candidate. Okay, what I want to know, pal, is everything in your life so perfect that you can attempt to clog up the courts with this trivial nonsense? I mean, seriously, you have a better chance of staging a palace coup if you want to become a member of the royal family. Anyway. Leonard Embody marched up and down a sidewalk in September in front of the Hillsborough High School in Nashville, Tennessee, in military clothing and with a rifle on his back and a GoPro camcorder attached to his chest. Now, this is just his latest street demonstration supporting Tennessee's open carry gun law. According to WSMV-TV in a report there, this episode made even some supporters edgy because of the school setting, but Embody failed to see the problem. He said, "Other people may think I look terrifying," he acknowledged, "but he doesn't think he does, and if you disagree, he suggests psychological counseling." Oh, really? He's the one suggesting psychological counseling for others? Well, Mr. Kettle, meet Mr. Pot. Anyway, Tennessee bans school guns, or bans guns, rather, on school property. But a few inches away, on the sidewalk, apparently according to Embry, he's decided that there is no problem to stand there with a gun. Okay, people, are you aware of the fact that from the sidewalk, bullets can reach the school? You figured that one out, right? Why hasn't anyone else here figured that one out? Therein lies my concern. Anyway, after a male shoplifter escaped an Orem, Utah jewelry store with a ring worth several $1,000s, police found the suspect's vehicle and pulled it over. Now, the store clerk identified the driver as the thief. He was accompanied by a woman. And according to police, according to Lieutenant Craig Martinez, no ring was found. And after several wild goose chases, we found out that the woman had swallowed the ring in an attempt to hide it when they were pulled over by police. 25-year-old Christina Schlegel was taken to hospital where an X-ray confirmed the ring was inside her. She and the man, Brian Ford, age 30, were charged with felony theft, and they are still waiting for the evidence several days later. The woman was being held in a cell without a flush toilet. No, she hasn't passed the ring yet, and no, we are not digging it out, Martinez said, telling the New York Daily News that we don't get paid enough to dig through people's bowel movements. Yeah, which leads me to ask the question, just what is the going rate these days if you want to hire someone to dig through people's bowel movements? And is that an hourly rate, a flat fee contract? And by the way, talk about a job with absolutely no perks. None. Anyway, a 38-year-old man was taken unconscious to St. Mary's Hospital in Rochester, Minnesota in August after allegedly choking his mother-in-law and refusing to cooperate with police who used a stun gun and chemical spray. And to no effect, by the way, did they use this chemical spray and stun gun. He seemed fine with both experiences, yet he dramatically knocked himself out with an empty beer bottle. Well, the Lord works in mysterious ways, huh? Sometimes you just have to get the desired effect in a different way. That's certainly the way in this case. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, the 911 call wasn't very compelling. The man told Fort Walton Beach, Florida police dispatchers that he was upset because he has food and not a fridge. What, wait? Yeah, that's right, you heard. His apartment manager, he explained, promised him a refrigerator, but hadn't provided it yet. The dispatcher told the man that it was neither an emergency nor a police matter, but the man defiantly said he didn't care and would keep calling 911 until he received satisfaction for his complaint. Over the next 2 hours, the man called seven more times with the same complaint, so officers were finally sent out. 60-year-old Richard Wilde admitted that he knew it was a civil matter and not an emergency, so he was arrested and charged with the misuse of 911. Well, you know what? Where he's going, they probably have a fridge. So, that should make him happy. Anyway, on to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. In my other life as a television news anchor at Global News here in Montreal, I had the chance to talk to Marc-André Bernier. He's the Parks Canada expedition leader who is searching for the sunken ships of the Franklin expedition up in Canada's Arctic. Now, one of the ships, the HMS Erebus, was found on September 7th. It's a major archaeological find, but it's also important to Canada's sovereignty, an issue that's not lost on Prime Minister Stephen Harper. I sat in a downtown Montreal park with cameras rolling to discuss the discovery with Marc-André, and here is part of the audio from that conversation.
How exciting was it when your crew first came across one of the Franklin ships?
Well, basically, when the ship appeared on the screen, the sonar image scrolls down like a waterfall, and even before it completely appeared, because it's fairly intact, the excitement was just there. Everybody knew and started celebrating. And so it was a very intense moment, because we've been looking for this for 6 years, and it was finally there. I was on another ship with one of our partners, Royal Geographical Society and Defence Research Canada, and when I learned, I came upon the Sir Wilfrid Laurier, and when they showed me the images, I mean, tears on my face, because it was just an intense moment, and the significance of the discovery was huge. So it was just it's a roller coaster of emotions.
A six-year search, how far from where you originally started searching, like how far from where you thought it was it actually?
Well, there's one thing to consider is that there's actually two vessels.
Right.
So, and according to Inuit testimony, they were lost in two different places. One drifted or was sailed a lot further out. So we had, it was in the box that we had targeted, but we were slowly working our way through it, because there's a lot of reefs, and what people don't realize is that we're actually charting as we're going. A lot of these waters are uncharted. You don't know what's ahead, so you have to be very careful. So it was actually in the box that we had targeted, and we were slowly moving towards it. The thing that really helped us is that while we were setting up some equipment to get precise measurements, well, the Coast Guard pilot, Andrew Sterling, who was with the government of Nunavut archaeologists, actually found a piece of the shipwreck on shore. So we moved the search to that area, and after not even two passes, boom, it was there, and it appeared. So that was kind of the clue that we were looking for, but it wasn't that box that we had targeted.
So finding the first one, does it make the search for the second one easier or harder?
While we've been looking for the second one at the same time, it doesn't change anything. What it does is that it gives credibility to the Inuit testimony. For the other one, it's not as clear. It's west of King William Island. So the problem there is that our window is a lot smaller, because there's a lot more ice in that area, so much that this year we had problems. We could not search in that area because there was too much ice. Even the Royal Canadian Navy ship Kingston could not come and help us out because there was too much ice. So that's the challenge, is that a smaller window, larger area.
The two ships, one was the Erebus?
Yes.
And the other one?
Terror.
And the Erebus is the one you found?
Yes.
Was that the one Franklin was actually on himself?
That was the flagship. It was the one that Franklin was on. Presumably the one that he died on. We know he died in 1847, almost a year before they abandoned the ships. So it was his flagship. There's not too much difference between the two. There's only about a meter, 3 feet. So the identification was touchy, because they are so much alike.
I know Stephen Harper, the Prime Minister, was very interested in this for sovereignty reasons, for Canada's sovereignty in the Arctic. But besides that, the fact that the Canadian government was so behind this process, was that a major boon to just the attitude of going forward in the search?
Well, I would say actually that you know, there's that whole sovereignty question, but there was a genuine historical interest from the Prime Minister. When we spoke to him about it, he knew the story. He knew the importance historically for Canadian history. So that aspect, certainly there was some interest aside from the sovereignty question. I mean, I think what was attractive to one of the attractive things about the story as well is that we are looking at a partnership that involves private sector and public sector. We have university as well, different levels of government. The government of Nunavut is there. So that whole way of doing business, it's not about just Franklin. It's about charting the Arctic, getting more science, some terrestrial archaeology. So that whole package actually is a very good story, a way of doing things, multiple objectives in an environment that's extremely harsh and unpredictable.
You said the Prime Minister knew the importance of this story. Do you think the general population is aware of the importance of the story?
Well, that's what we're trying to do, is to enhance that. But I think a lot of Canadians are aware of the importance for different reasons. I mean, I think they recognize various things. Of course, it's a mystery, it's a myth, but it's exploration. It's the story of human exploration. It's also the story of encounters. When you think of it, some of the Inuit and the Europeans were meeting for the first time. So that it's a Canadian story. It's the story about the North. It's a story about Inuit. It's a story about exploration. It's trying to tame that environment. So it's a Canadian story now, even though it's a British story as well. So it's a global, it's really a global story that a lot of Canadians, maybe not as much in Quebec than the rest of Canada, but there's always a lot of interest in the search, and now even more.
So now that the ship has been found, at least one of the ships have been found, what happens with what is actually on the ship? Does it get brought up? Does it stay there as a memorial of some kind? What happens?
Well, we haven't seen any human remains yet. The ships may have just drifted abandoned, so there's a possibility that there's no human remains. But we're looking at it as basically a historical crime scene. We want to solve some questions. We have an opportunity to, and I've said that before, to look history in the eyes. I mean, we're given a gift here to understand what happened 168 years ago. So what we have to do is to approach it as it is a crime scene. We're detectives of the past. We're going to go methodically, record everything, remove objects to learn from them, but also to interpret and show people. So that's the idea. But we have to record and make sure we proceed without destroying any evidence to help us understand what happened when they abandoned the ship.
And if stuff is brought up, who gets to claim it, Canada or Britain?
Well, we have an MOU and an understanding with Great Britain, and the ship belongs. It's a Royal Navy ship. The artifacts that are brought up, we have an agreement that Canada can get these artifacts, but we will work with them and the government of Nunavut, of course, to see where these artifacts will go. But first of all, one thing to understand is that when an object stays in the water for that long, you can't just bring it up. You have to conserve it. And that's the first process that's going to happen.
And besides taking a look at what's down there now and perhaps finding the second ship, how excited are you now for what's to come in this explorative quest?
For an archaeologist, it doesn't get any better. It's Disneyland for us. I mean, it's extremely exciting. We have a chance to really work on a very important site for our country, but also globally, as I said. But it's also a big responsibility. We know that we have a chance to look at a very important moment in history. So we're going to proceed methodically, but that's our job, that's what we do. So it is extremely exciting. We're getting feedback from all over the world on this incredible find. So for us, we can't wait to go back. The frustration part was that we had a window of 5 days to dive, and we only got in after 3 days and a half. So we only got 2 days, really, to be honest. So the expectation for 3 days, we were just like waiting on the Sir Wilfrid Laurier just to have a chance to go out and dive. So that was an agonizing moment, because we were saying, what if we can't? We have to wait till next year. But we were lucky to have one break in weather for 2 days, and after that, it closed off for the season.
Well, congratulations. I'm sure a lot of people, not just in the rest of Canada, but also in Quebec, are very interested, because this has become a quest in itself. Just like Franklin going out, searching for Franklin has become, romanticized, but there's an interest in it that I don't think a lot of people have followed through up until now.
And you know, the parallel is very interesting with what you're saying, is that we are doing what they were doing at that time. They were exploring, they were charting, they were mapping. We were doing the same. We're charting the Arctic. We're doing science. They were doing science. So basically, it's a parallel that exists of what we're doing now is the same thing.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
That was part of a conversation I had with Marc-André Bernier, the Parks Canada Expedition leader, who found the sunken ship of the Franklin Expedition up in Canada's Arctic. He may sound like a humble and unassuming scientist, but this underwater archaeologist really is Canada's answer to Indiana Jones. It's very fascinating work that he and his crew have accomplished, and there's still a lot more to come. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. With the Ebola virus now making news in the United States, there's been a renewed focus on other infectious diseases here too. Measles, the fastest spreading disease in human history, is now appearing again after experts thought it was wiped out here just 14 years ago. Why? One major reason is that more and more people are deciding not to vaccinate their children out of fear that the vaccines are toxic. One of the reasons for this fear is that several years ago, a medical researcher caused widespread panic by claiming that some vaccines could actually harm children by causing autism. Let's be fair, this is a very serious issue. What many people don't know, however, is that a couple of years ago, a respected medical journal exposed that researcher as a fraud. He was paid by plaintiff lawyers to manufacture evidence for lawsuits they had filed against vaccine makers. In short, it was a scam, but it's behind the return of some diseases once thought to be extinct. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Coming to you from Canada, the land of universal health care, colorful money, and the correct spelling of the word theater. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about the murder of former NFLer Steve McNair. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way, and a few more Stuff File stories to get to before we get to our next guest. On a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, a Detroit homeowner selling an investor special house has lowered the asking price from $5,000 to an iPhone 6. Larry Eltz, who is a real estate broker for the unidentified man who lives in Austria, said his client is willing to trade the rundown investor special home for the latest iPhone, but he will accept a 32-gigabyte iPad. This house is really not worth much at all, Eltz told ABC News. He said his client purchased the house for $41,000 in 2010 and only later learned the seller had purchased it for $10,500 only 2 weeks earlier. Eltz said his client was a victim himself. The home, which has no front door, has since accumulated more than $6,000 in back taxes and is due to go into foreclosure next year if the taxes remain unpaid. Eltz says there has been some interest in the home since the offer went public, including a potential buyer who offered an iPhone 5, an older model than the asking price, and another who offered $850. The broker said one woman said she was interested in the house for the wood because she needed white pine planks. Actually, this is just another sad story about the state of decline of Detroit. I'm surprised China hasn't bought the city yet. Or maybe they have. Anyway, 13-year-old Kyle Bradford didn't want to eat his burrito. I really wasn't that hungry. A friend of his didn't want to eat his cheese sandwich. He didn't like it. So Bradford gave his friend the burrito. Problem solved. Nope. This was a public school. Problem created. We have a policy that prohibits students from exchanging meals, said Trinity Alps, California school superintendent Tom Barrett. Because of safety and liability, we cannot allow students to actually exchange meals. Bradford got a detention. And there you have it. Another pinhead zero-tolerance school story. Hell in a handbasket, I say. Hell in a handbasket. Anyway, let's get to our last guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Vincent Hill is a former Nashville police officer and also a fan of the NFL's Tennessee Titans. The murder of quarterback Steve McNair was not only shocking to him, but it also became part of his life over the last 5 years. Vincent is the author of Playbook to a Murder and also the follow-up book, Incomplete Pass. He joins us on the line right now from Atlanta. Hi, Vincent.
Hello. Thanks for having me, sir.
Thanks for being on the program with us. Now, when this unfortunate incident took place, several years ago, it was first thought that it was a murder-suicide, but that's something you never believed, right?
That's correct. The case was
closed in a matter of 3 days by my former department, Nashville Police Department. But when you look at the facts of the case and how Steve was murdered, or should I say executed, you know, it just never added up to a murder-suicide. Steve McNair was shot once in each temple and twice in the chest at center mass. You know, something not typical of a 20-year-old female who supposedly never picked up a gun before July 4th of 2009.
So the initial situation, the initial belief was that she shot him and then shot herself.
Correct.
Why do you think the Nashville Police Department was in such a hurry to rule it a murder-suicide?
Well, I mean, you got to look at who it was. I mean, it was Steve McNair. I mean, former Titans quarterback, former Baltimore Ravens quarterback. You know, everyone in the city of Nashville knew Steve. So Nashville Police knew, had they not closed the case and closed it quickly, several questions would have been flooding into them. So I think it was a rush to judgment on their part. You know, you have this girl found at the crime scene. You have a gun found at the crime scene. So the easy scenario is murder-suicide without taking in any other factors.
Okay, so the police department lets this go, but you can't let this go. Some people might think, you know, gosh, you're tilting at windmills. Everyone seems to be putting this away, but you can't let this go. What was it about this that you said, I've got to see this through?
Well, you know, honestly, I made a promise to both families. I actually, after this happened, reached out to Sahel Kazemi's family first via Facebook, and several months later had the opportunity to meet Steve McNair's family in Mississippi. And, you know, neither one, surprisingly, especially Steve's family, never believed it was a murder-suicide. You know, there's several factors that I discuss in both books that point into who had a more logical, or should I say more beneficial, gain of Steve being dead other than Sahel Kazemi. So, you know, I made a promise to both families, and, you know, I intend to keep that promise.
Now, it's interesting. You said that both families, especially Steve's family, believe that it was not a murder-suicide. And I find that interesting only because you would think the more adamant, the more righteous of the two would be the parents of the woman who was accused of being the murderer in this case.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, that in itself speaks volumes. When, you know, when I sat down with Steve's mother, when I met her in 2010, and when she looked at me and said, Vince, I never believed that this young lady killed my son. And then when we started talking about things that were missing from the crime scene, like Steve being worth upwards of $30 million at the time of his death, but found with no money on him. And, you know, she's even asking Nashville police, well, who robbed my son? You know, he would typically have $7,000 or $8,000 on him. I mean, Steve was found with $7 in his wallet. So, you know, these are a lot of questions that are still not answered to this day.
Okay, so we need a suspect. If not her, then who?
Well, you look at a guy, Adrian Gilliam, who, you know, told police initially the day after the murders that he only sold the gun to a girl whose name he didn't know, and come to find out, based on phone records, they had texted and talked over 300 times in the 2 weeks leading to the murders. And Adrian Gilliam's a guy who was once in prison for armed robbery and murder, and one of the last people, actually the last person to call Sahel Kazemi just an hour and a half before the murders. So you got to look at that, then you got to look at who had the most to gain. You know, in my books, especially Incomplete Pass, you know, there was a person that benefited greatly from Steve's death, and it was not Sahel Kazemi. There was a person who took Steve's mother out of the house that Steve built for her in Mississippi and then sold it. They sold the land that Steve had left to his mother. They sold the cattle. They sold everything. Then they told Steve's mother, hey, you can't even use your son's name for any benefit. So, again, who had the most to benefit? A 20-year-old who had a Cadillac Escalade, who was taking trips to Vegas, who I know for a fact was getting $3,000 or $4,000 a week, or was it someone else that could have stood to gain $20 or $30 million?
So where does this investigation, or lack thereof, stand right now with the police in Nashville? Are they reopening this situation? Do they still say it's murder-suicide? Where does it stand officially?
Well, the official conclusion is that it's closed. It was a murder-suicide. I did attempt to reopen the case via the grand jury in 2010. That was denied. Steve McNair's mother actually went to Nashville with a few other people, looked at crime scene photos, and they still had more questions than answers because, according to everyone that saw the crime scene photos, the crime scene was staged. But officially it's closed, but I can tell you that from our end, there's still things we're working on to get the case reopened.
Do you think it's an individual that may be involved in this, or is it some sort of conspiracy?
I think there are several individuals that had a role in one way or the other, from the gun to, you know, the financial gains to keeping Steve's name quiet. You know, there's several factors. Adrian Gilliam himself couldn't have pulled this off. And when you look at Adrian Gilliam, if he was not involved in these murders in any way, he never would have lied to the police. But he lied from day one. He lied when he signed his proffer agreement, giving him immunity. He lied about his alibi, which was contradicted. So, you know, his story never made sense. So there's definitely a conspiracy here. Steve McNair had to die. Steve McNair probably had to die on that night. And unfortunately, Sahel Kazemi just happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time, because there's several witness statements that told police that they were supposed to hang out that night, but since they couldn't hang out with Sahel, she attempted to make plans with Steve, and at 10:20, she texted Steve to go have drinks outside in public, but Nashville police want everyone to believe that she lured Steve McNair to the condominium after buying a gun at 6 o'clock to shoot him four times and kill herself.
And again, under the theories that you're working on, the motive for the murder would be what?
Financial gain.
Just financial gain.
Correct.
The reason why I asked this conspiracy question, the idea that maybe several people are involved, you are a former police officer, so you know the dangers of certain investigations. You're going around, you've written now two books about this situation, you're not letting this go. Are you concerned or worried about your own safety due to the fact that you keep dredging this up, and you know, as you say, there are guilty parties who are out there who don't want to be brought to justice. So does that put you in danger?
You know, I never think about it simply because, you know, I answer to a higher power, and I do believe no weapon formed against me shall prosper. And not only that, if something were to happen to me, I think the world would start to take a look and say, hey, you know, maybe this crazy ex-police officer from Nashville, Tennessee, maybe he was right. And, you know, I even have old friends in the department, you know, not to be named, of course, for obvious reasons, that, you know, support me in what I'm doing and, you know, tell me, hey, I think you're on the right track, but you're getting cut off at the toes. So I've never been worried about that.
So officially, is there some light at the end of the tunnel? Is there a possibility that somebody will reopen this investigation and the truth will be found out, or Are you still, like, literally hitting brick walls?
I think there is light at the end of the tunnel. There's a new district attorney in Nashville that just got elected, so I do plan on setting a meeting with him. I know we're going to take another trip back to Nashville Police to relook at the crime scene photos, and this time we're going to tell them we want all the photos. Last time, Lucille McNair was only shown about 20 of the 516 photos that were taken. And most of those were pictures of the bathroom, the garage, nothing that had anything to do with the crime. So that's our focus now.
You have the support of both families involved, but the NFL is often considered a family in itself. Has anyone from the Tennessee Titans, from management on down, reached out to you, or have you reached out to them? Do they agree with your assessment?
No one from the Titans specifically. I have talked to some former players that played with Steve that are still in the league. Some have retired since then. And, you know, they've shown their support, you know, from what I've done and what I'm doing. But no one is officially from the Titans or the NFL.
It's a fascinating story indeed. And, well, thanks to you, one that is not going away. Your first book is Playbook to a Murder. The second one, the follow-up, Incomplete Pass. I thank you very, very much, Vincent, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Yes, sir. My pleasure. Thank you.
Vincent Hill, author of Playbook to a Murder and the follow-up book, Incomplete Pass. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0269, and you'll find the links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his books directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
In Londonderry, Northern Ireland, in August, 20-year-old Kevin Clarence was arrested for an inept attempt to rob a supermarket. He entered the store and only then, according to witnesses, put a plastic garbage bag over his head and decided to wait in line for his opportunity to address the cashier. He quickly got tired of waiting and said, "I'll be back," but was caught by police minutes after leaving the store. Wow, a plastic bag. Seriously? I mean, it's a wonder he didn't suffocate in line. But you know the usual answer, don't you, regardless of the question? In this case, why would someone go into a store with the intent of robbing the place, put a bag over his head, which is only going to draw attention to himself, and then wait in line to be served? Well, one reason, and one reason only. He's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0269. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0269. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Guests of the Stuff File program stay at their own homes.
Trust me, I'm the voice for this program. I know there's no budget for accommodations. I'm reading this on a futon.